ABC Grandstand. Sports coverage like no other.
Hello, and thanks for downloading this ABC Grandstand podcast. For sports coverage like no other, tune into ABC Grandstand on ABC Local Radio, on the ABC mobile app, streaming online at abc.net.au/grandstand, and on ABC Grandstand Digital Radio.
He hits him straight back down the ground in the air. He could be caught. He's out.
Outside the off stump, and that's four runs. And cracking it away off the back foot.
With just the pressure of an Ashes series. Looking at each other going, wait a minute, this pitch is doing nothing. And now the pressure is right back with that big booming drive.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Cricket Council is now in session.
I feel like I should bang me gavel or something because this is my first session in charge of the Cricket Council, but I've been looking forward to it. Daniel Norcross from testmatchsofa.com joins us. Hi, Daniel.
Hello, how you doing?
I'm not too bad. Gee, you're not sounding too enthusiastic. You don't sound very pumped, Daniel.
It's weird, that, isn't it? I don't know why. I call it a very long, hard 5 weeks through the middle of the night, watching cruel and unusual punishment played out in a variety of different medieval ways, I suppose. And eventually it takes its toll. But, strangely, every new test match brings with it a new hope, however utterly futile that hope may be.
I like it. And I think I know Francis, I've heard him say this, but I like hearing English people having to sit up in the middle of the night to watch stuff because we do it all the time. I'm an English Premier League fan as well, and it always involves long and sort of, you know, sort of bleak hours in the middle of the night sitting up to watch sport. So it's good to see you lot getting some of your own back. So pleased to have you on board, and we'll talk more about what you're expecting today, and see if you can actually come up with any justification at all for that resurgent optimism. And Mel Jones, a former Australian cricketer, is also with us, another regular on the cricket panel. So you guys have all done this Cricket Council more than I have, so I'm hoping you all take charge and know what to do and what to say. Hi, Mel, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. I don't think I'm going to have as flowering, descriptive introduction as Daniel, but I am certainly looking forward to the test.
You are, of course, but it makes sense that you're looking forward to it because you're an Aussie, and someone else, of course, looking forward to it is an old friend of yours, Lisa Stelaker, who's in the studio. I've got to say, Lisa was very excited to hear that you were going to be one of the people she'd be getting a chance to talk to this morning.
You've got to get out more, doesn't she?
Oh, thanks, Jonesy.
That's all right, Chaka. How are you?
I'm good, mate.
So can you tell us any Lisa Stelaker stories that are usable on air at the moment, just to give people a bit of background on it?
Careful, Jonesy.
How much time have we got? Yeah. I'm not too sure if it's if people at 7:20 are ready for those stories just as yet. I'll see how the morning pans out.
Okay. Well, let's just might go around the panel and ask firstly what lineup you're expecting to see from England today, and whether you think I always feel with these Australian fitness last minute fitness tests, you know, Ryan Harris, Shane Watson's point, I sometimes feel like they've got to have a couple of players who've got a dodgy hammy or something, or a wonky knee, leading into every test so that the media's got something to write about. Do any of you have any doubt that those guys will play? Start with you, Ryan, Daniel, rather. And secondly, do you think that England will be making changes?
No, the Australian team will be exactly the same. I mean, it's one of these important things that's kind of, it's a big statement, isn't it? We've put out the same team for five tests running. Doesn't happen very often. England nearly managed it in 2005, of course, and then Simon Jones got injured, and as a result, Paul Collingwood got an MBE. I think Australia, they will do whatever they can to get the same team out, and I'm fully expecting to be the same team, and it should be. It's quite right. England, because, I mean, what you need to do when you're in a terrible situation, and it's absolutely essential you win a test match, is try and get three people who've never played test cricket before and put them straight into the heat of battle. So what we will do is wait until the least appropriate pitch and then unleash the giant Irishman, Boyd Rankin, whose pace and bounce will be utterly nullified by a slow Sydney track. I think Gary Ballant, who might have actually had a pretty good series as a batsman, they rated him highly. I mean, you could tell by the way they were picking him in the early warm-up games, and especially over Bairstow. He'll finally come in when it's a completely lost cause, I would think. And, well, the other one is an enforced change because Monty Panesar is injured. So there's this guy, Scott Borthwick, and I would say that he was probably about eighth on the list of spinners that English people would have chosen. You wouldn't know a great deal about him. He's in a long line of English leg spinners, by which I mean people who can be relied upon to bowl at least one long hop and one full toss per over. He can bat, which is a great thing, but when you're going to Sydney and we think it might spin, being shorn of our two best spinners who bowled India out frequently in India and replacing them with a part-time leg spinner isn't great. So that'll basically be the England team. Sorry to sound so despondent. They might do very well.
No, we don't apologise. We love it hearing you sound despondent. That's why we have you on the program. You know, we would have quietly dropped you from the Cricket Council if England were sort of three up at this stage of the season. But,
thank you.
Lisa, do you want to take issue with that description of your standard leg spinner?
Oh, gee, well, it is the hardest trade in cricket. But, yeah, Scott has been out here with Northern Districts, and I think he was in the England Academy. Would that be he was supposed to tour Sri Lanka?
That's right.
Yeah. So they've decided because he's already out here, they save on an air ticket. Would that be correct as well?
Yeah, it's that as well.
Yeah.
So pennies at this point.
Yeah. So, it'll be interesting. Obviously, Brad Haddin has played with him. So it'll be interesting to see how they go against each other. I can imagine Brad would be quietly whispering in his ear.
Mel, have you ever heard of Scott Borthwick? I heard of him because Graham Swan mentioned him sort of as he was bolting out the door with his boarding pass in hand.
No, I certainly haven't. I did have a quick little Google because that's where you all go to for, you know, a wealth of information. And
that's called extensive research these
days. Yeah, it certainly was. And I did notice that I think he ranked about 14th on the Durham bowling averages last season. So he's up there. And I tell you what, I will never speak of cricket ever again if the Aussies don't attack him and attack him hard if he does get in. So I think he's in for a bit of a bruising introduction to international cricket if he gets the call up.
Now, in terms of the Sydney pitch, Lisa's the expert there. This whole sort of default description of SCG as a spinner's paradise, how accurate is that these days?
Well, yesterday when I was up in the media centre, I had a nice look and took a photo, and the wicket actually looks fairly, has a greenish tinge to it, and there's a fair bit of grass. So whether Tommy Parker takes a bit more off end of yesterday or early this morning, but it will turn, but I think there's going to be, you know, something in it, and the humidity out there at the moment, I think the ball will do a fair bit in the first session.
So you don't think Michael Clarke will be tempted he might be tempted to bowl. Sorry, I was going to say he wouldn't do it again. But, yeah, what you're describing may be a scenario. But having nearly had it bite him last time, that will make him think long and hard.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there was some close encounters over at the MCG, and I'm sure he would have been holding his breath at some time. But I think if they're confident that their bowlers are fully fit, and ready to attack the English batters, then I wouldn't be surprised.
Mel, who do you expect when you say you'd be really disappointed if they don't go after someone like Borthwick really hard? I suppose Dave Warner's the main candidate. He has to hang around long enough for the slow bowlers to come on, of course. But who else do you think would be the kind of guy that could do some damage, or who you would like to see do some damage to a rookie England spinner?
Oh, look, I think it's a mindset right across the entire squad, and I think the Australians have typically done that right across, you know, probably the last 20 years with, you know, a variety of different selections. And, I mean, we usually do it with the touring England captain. We try and get him early and put him on the back foot. And now we're doing it with spinners. We've done it with English spinners over the last couple of years. I think it was Kerrigan over in the Ashes just 6 months ago. So I don't think it'll be any one specific player. I mean, Clark's got fantastic footwork to spinners. He'll certainly have a dip. Warner, as we know, is an exceptionally attacking player anyways. So I think it'll be just one of those positions that the Australian squad will take. And I think, I suppose, if I put my money on anyone, I reckon Will be Haddin. One, he's played against him, but two, he's just in some absolutely sublime form at the moment. And I think he'll sort of say to anyone who comes on with the ball that I'm hitting him well, and we'll see how it goes.
Daniel, Who's the villain of the Australian team in terms of the English fans and English media? I mean, apart from all of them generally, but is
That's a really good question, actually, because we were talking about this in summer and actually through this series. And the problem is that we tend to like most of your team. I mean, even Michael Clarke is kind of likeable in his post-match press conferences, and also because of the suspicion in which he's held by all right-thinking Australians for being an Australian. So, we have sympathy for him. Obviously, everybody loves Chris Rogers because he's thoroughly upstanding and plays for Middlesex, and we all like him a lot. We can even like Stephen Smith. Who don't we like? It's really just David Warner and Mitchell Johnson, because the rest of them, I mean, Nathan Lyon looks like a guy who'd ask you for change at a bus stop. He looks like a very likeable kind of guy. Most of the team, although Shane Watson, of course, is only dislikable because he looks like he's going to burst into tears at any moment, which is obviously an unusual attribute for an international sportsman. And the shock and horror on his face if he either misses a ball or gets hit for four is one that it's like a child is having his Christmas presents taken away from him. It's very unusual. But I would say it's only those three. The thing is that when they work collectively, though, they become like a kind of pack of hyenas, so that even the thoroughly likeable George Bailey, who for me is one of the most fantastic cricketers in the world, for the simple reason that when he captained Australia in ODIs, when you lost, he had exactly the same smile on his face as when you won. He was just he was the kind of bloke who would knock on the door and sell you chamois leathers, you know, and you'd probably do it because he seemed such a likeable guy. But then put them all together and bring them a piece of fresh English meat, and they just simply gorge on it. And it's kind of frightening to watch at 3:30 in the morning when you're sleep-deprived and you've been commentating for 4.5 hours. But I don't know if that answers your question, because basically, what I've told you is that we like eight of the team. One of them we're slightly suspicious of in Watson, and Warner and Johnson are obviously hate figures for, I mean, one for a moustache, well, two moustaches. Two very, very bad moustaches. And kind of inappropriately unnecessary sledging when you've thrashed someone. I mean, you know, it's like you just wouldn't imagine the Spanish Inquisition would be gloating after they put someone on a rack and ripped off two limbs. You know, at that point, you can actually bury them.
Let's look at it. Maybe a tougher question. Is there any of the English team that the English fans still like?
Now that's a much, much more difficult question to answer. Future boy, as we call him, Ben Stokes, he's still got some credit in the bank for that 100, and he looks like he's going to provide England with the balance that we've been searching for since about 1985, after Ian Botham, well, 86-7 really, after Ian Botham became sort of too corpulent. We've been searching for somebody who could bat at six and be a frontline bowler, and I think people like him.
He's a ringer as well, which helps.
Yeah, exactly. There's absolutely no jealousy involved, is there? He can have his hundreds. He needs them, frankly, because he's got little else going for him. It's hard. I mean, the problem is that people, I think, know that Kevin Peterson, Ian Bell, Alistair Cook are the best batsmen in the country. So they know we've still got to pick them. And I guess it'll be very interesting, the distinction between 5-0 and 4-0 or 4-1, because if it's 5-0, then people actually demand that we execute in this country. You know, somebody, heads have to roll. Whereas 4-1, you can get away with a sort of small and polite inquiry and hope that 5 months later everyone's memories will be wiped. We've been used to 4-1s over the years, but 5-0s come round, you know, not so often.
But Daniel, do you actually need a 4-0, 5-0 result for things to actually change? Or, you know, is a 4-1 result actually just covering things up?
Well, that's a very good question. I think if it is 5-0, the danger is that the wrong things will change because you get the knee-jerk reaction. You know, there are some things in place that are good, and the structure, I think, of English cricket has improved enormously over the last 10 years, partly through selection with Jeff Miller. The ECB's got a lot tighter. They got a lot. You know, they're just a lot more professional as an outfit, and you'll have seen that with the way the women's team have been playing in the last 10 years or so as well. So what you hope is that you get the right change, and wholesale changes are not what's required here. It's actually, I think, it's about the same group of people being together for too long. And there needs to be an evolution or a revolution. I guess the fear with 5-0 is that we'll have a look at some of these guys and say, right, that's it, we've got to have a new broom. And you can't really bring a side in just like that. We've only got a year and a half till the next Ashes. And we're hoping that by then some of your players won't be around because they're getting on. And we need to have integrated some good young players and have maintained what is a pretty successful core, really.
Just quickly to both Mel and Lisa before we go, I'm being astounded to see people are asking questions about whether Alistair Cook deserves to stay on as England captain. Do you think that that's fair that he would be questioned if it is a 5-0, that his security as captain would be an issue if they lose 5-0, Lisa, firstly?
Look, I think losing a series 5-0 will hurt him as a captain a hell of a lot. I think that he's had players, he's had Jonathan Trott, Graham Swan, he's had some key players that have left the team, which puts him in a difficult situation. And he hasn't been having a great summer himself. So I think, like Daniel said, there's a good core group there that have been successful.
Do you keep him as captain?
I think so. I can't. I don't know who. Maybe Daniel can tell us who they have in mind after Alistair Cook, but I can't.
I think Joe Root, and that's too soon.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think there's someone standing out saying, pick me for captain, I'm ready to go. I think that, Alistair Cook will still perform well as England captain for a number of years.
And your opinion, Mel?
Completely. I'd be absolutely devastated for bloke if they dropped him now. He's come into an England side as a captain, and he's had a really good tenure, and this is probably the first time he's been really, truly tested. And he, as Lisa said, there's been a multitude of other things going on and around him. For mine, I think that the support team have to rally around him and provide him the support structure for him to learn as much as possible so that the next time this comes around, he's in a better place to handle it. And I think he will be. But England certainly need him as a core fixture in the next couple of years.
Yeah, he's not an English Premier League coach or manager. Leave him alone just for a little bit longer. That's how I'd feel anyway. All right, well, it's been fabulous being in charge of the Cricket Council for this morning. Terrific talking to you, Daniel Norcross from testmatchsofa.com. Listened to you so many times. Nice to actually be on the other end of the phone call for once.
It's been a huge pleasure. Thank you.
And Mel Jones, the former Australian cricketer, another regular on the ABC Grandstand Digital Breakfast Show Cricket Council. Thanks for the chat, Mel.
Great to chat. And just remember, guys, we're going to win another Ashes starting Jan 10 at the Wacker with the women's as well.
That's definitely on the agenda for us to have a chat about with Lisa at some stage this morning as well.
Grandstand Breakfast on Grandstand Digital.
Grandstand Digital Breakfast. Good morning, Debbie Spillane, keeping you company. In the absence of Francis Leach, who's having his summer holiday, prepping, I imagine, for the Australian Open tennis. He'll be involved in our coverage of that for ABC Grandstand Digital. Looking forward to that a lot. But meantime, let's catch up with Andre Leslie, who some of you may know. He does some Grandstand Digital programs. The Cool Room is one you may have heard him on before, and I had a chat to him just before Christmas in Happier Days about the release of his book, Berlin Cricket, about cricket in Berlin and or in Germany in general. But he joins us now in his capacity as an editor with Deutsche Welle Radio, the German national broadcaster, to tell us the latest on the Michael Schumacher drama. Still in hospital in France after a skiing accident. Good morning, Andre.
Yeah, good evening, Debbie, from here.
Oh, that's right. Of course, it's not morning at all over there. Just firstly, what's the latest? I imagine it's something you're monitoring around the clock as the German national broadcaster.
Yeah, well, we are, definitely. I must say that I suppose the story's fallen off the top headlines at the moment because there's been no major difference, really, over the last 24 hours, 48 hours. We were told yesterday, German time, from Sabine Kim, that's the manager of Michael Schumacher. She's been the manager for years, for him, that Schumacher is in a critical but stable condition. And they basically said, until anything changes, you're not going to hear anything more from the hospital medical staff either. So they're shutting up shop there in Grenoble, and the manager has said that yesterday. There was a similar statement from her again this morning, and I think that's pretty much all we're going to hear for the next few days.
is there any sense that the longer this situation goes on, the more optimistic the outlook is, or is it not an indicator?
Well, I mean, everyone's weighing in with their opinion, and you can imagine the German media is asking, you know, neurosurgeon experts and stuff a lot. From what I hear from them, I'm certainly no neurosurgeon. They do say that the fact that he's still alive and we're still not hearing any further news, but aside from a critical and stable condition, is a good thing. Once it comes to about 3 weeks, that's when things start to get, pretty difficult if he hasn't awoken from that coma. He was put into that coma to really reduce the whole body system operations just to make survival and any bleeding just reduce as much as possible. They've done two operations on him. That second one, I think, was Monday. So, I mean, it's now really just a wait and see, really.
Okay, and what? Just take us back to when the incident first occurred last week. Just take us through the reaction in Germany and the kind of coverage that it has had.
Well, it had a lot of coverage. I suppose it came out on Sunday evening with a lot of people tweeting about it. I think there was pretty quick reports as well from the ski resort itself, Méribel in France, where he skied regularly, and they did recognise him very, very quickly straight after the accident happened. There's been some details coming out of that accident, namely that he was going off-piste and skiing in an area where one normally wouldn't, and that he made a turn, hit a rock and was sent flying. But they said pretty quickly, the doctors, that there would have been no chance of him surviving if he hadn't been wearing a helmet. So all of this stuff came out as a bit of a shock. A couple of years back in Germany, we had a very prevalent politician who was very, very badly injured in a ski accident, and he actually killed someone who he collided with who wasn't wearing a helmet. So this issue is something that the German populace is starting to, I suppose, become quite aware of, and it didn't surprise me that there was such an outpouring of concern and emotion, even though Michael Schumacher at times here in Germany hasn't been the most popular sports star. Although he won 7 world championships and I had a lot of success, somehow I got the feeling always that the German sporting fans didn't really like him as they do, for instance, a Sebastian Vettel figure. So it was surprising to see all of that outpouring of emotion. Obviously the social network stuff went crazy. And a lot of people weighing in there, including sports stars and fellow racers.
I don't know whether you saw any of the reaction. I think it was, well, yesterday, our time. Apparently, Lewis Hamilton tweeted some photos or put up on social media some photos of himself skiing. And there was a bit of a backlash, people saying, well, that's pretty poor timing and in bad taste considering the situation. Has that news hit the awareness in where you are in Germany?
No, I don't think it has. I mean, all I've seen is a lot of the former racers weighing in. And as I say, what's also been surprising there is a lot of people like David Coulthard, for instance, you know, who's had a lot of well-publicised battles on the racetrack with Michael Schumacher, everyone getting in behind him and supporting him. Certainly that Lewis Hamilton thing didn't get picked up by the media. It's probably the only thing that hasn't got picked up by the media, but... yeah, no, that hasn't been an issue here at all.
All right, Andre, journalists have been going, I've heard, crazy lengths to get a scoop trying to get into the hospital to, I don't know, obviously they can't talk to Schumacher because he's unconscious. What can you tell us about that angle of things, the lengths people are going to try and get some sort of scoop on this?
Well, it's been amazing to watch this, Debbie, and especially as a journalist yourself, you really start to question what's going on here. I mean, the entire
parking area... Why didn't I do something respectable with my life sort of thing?
Sort of. I mean, you see the entire car park of this hospital there in Grenoble, which we need to remember is an area that specialises in brain surgery and emergency surgery for ski accidents. It's the main centre for these sorts of accidents in the area. There's been journalists blocking the emergency entry. You know, there's been journalists apparently, allegedly dressing up as priests to try and get through to Michael Schumacher's bedside. I mean, it sort of makes your skin crawl, really. I will think that over the next few weeks it will die down. And the doctors, you can see it on their faces. They're just pleading for everyone, really, to just let them go back to their work, not just dealing with Michael Schumacher's injury, which is certainly a very serious one, but also all the other people that come into this hospital every day. You know, it's a busy place. And it's, I hope it dies down a little bit, the media interest, and hopefully we get some good news. But I'm not tipping it to be in the next couple of days. I'm, as I say, no doctor, but from what you hear and the analysis that you hear here in the press, it would definitely be a factor of weeks or maybe even months before a proper sort of recovery or any sort of public appearance from Schumacher is taking place. Apparently the first picture has already, under the paparazzi members here, a price tag of $1 million if he gets out and a photo is taken of him. I hope they don't push that any further and we see him hopefully healthy some stage in the next few months.
I believe he's always kept his family life reasonably private. Has his wife been put under much pressure or is she managing to fly below the radar?
Well, Corinna, is staying out of this. Corinna Schumacher, they've been married many years and he's always been someone who's tried to keep his kids out of it as well. Obviously, he was skiing at the time, so they're definitely with them. So they're definitely there. They're at his bedside. But we certainly haven't had interviews with them or anything like that. And I hope that there's a little bit of respect being shown by the journalists involved towards the family because it was really obvious throughout Schumacher's career that he never wanted his family to be in the limelight. He often hogged the limelight himself, but you got the feeling that that was something he was in control of, whereas I think everyone here is probably respecting the fact that his family really doesn't want to come in front of the cameras.
Okay, Andre, well, thanks very much for talking to us from Germany. And as you say, you're not expecting anything to develop over the next couple of days in terms of Michael Schumacher's condition. But if it does, we'll definitely get back to you and get the update. And meantime, any news on your book, the Batting for Berlin? How's it going?
Yeah, well, it's going okay, Deb. I suppose it's something that I've been struggling to sell here in Germany. As we talked about it a little while back, it's the cricket market is relatively small here in Germany. I think, as you can see from this, Formula One and Bundesliga, of course, are the two big sellers over here. So I'm not expecting big sales in Germany, but all the more thankful for any people who are interested in the book there in Australia.
All right, Andre Leslie from Deutsche Welle Radio, thank you very much for your time this morning or this evening in your part of the world, and we'll chat again, I'm sure.
Yeah, no worries, Deb.